I'd like to go ahead and introduce all of our panelists tonight. We have a great lineup here. We have two professors and three students. So I'm going to start off by introducing Nancy Mahoney. Nancy, can you just give a wave? Okay, there we go. Nancy is a professor at Montana State University teaching in American Studies and Anthropology. She's also working on her PhD in American Studies. Nancy has a BA in Anthropology from Emory University and a Master's degree in Anthropology from George Washington University. Nancy is a great mentor to her students, as you'll witness tonight, and she does an amazing job of engaging students in archaeology and original research projects, showing students how important and exciting archaeology can be. Her dedication to students and the passion for her work is a natural catalyst, bringing students into the fields of archaeology and history. She's a wonderful professor and a wonderful teacher, so glad to have her and glad to have her as a colleague and a friend. Jack Fisher. Jack, give a wave. All right. Jack is an associate professor of anthropology at Montana State University. Dr. Fisher's archaeological research interests include lifeways and adaptations of prehistoric hunter-gatherers of Montana and also of southern Africa. Jack has also carried out ethno-archaeological research among hunter-gatherer peoples of Central and Southern Africa. Jack has been teaching at MSU since 1990 and has also given students wonderful opportunities to engage in original research here at Montana State University, including me a long time ago. Grace Dorman. Grace, if you could raise your hand. Grace was born and raised in Minnesota. She came to Montana State University in the fall of 2016, transferring in from Texas Christian University, where she studied cultural anthropology. She has been working for Nancy on the Fort Ellis Project since her first semester here at MSU. This was her first archaeological experience, but I dare say she may be hooked. Grace has really enjoyed her work with the Fort Ellis Project, but would also like to pursue the field of medical anthropology. Danny Krauss, Danny, give a wave, there we go. Grew up in Livingston, a fellow Livingstonite, and he is majoring in anthropology and minoring in astrobiology at Montana State University. He works at Bridger Bowl during the ski season and is a diehard ski bum when he's not in the archaeology lab with Jack analyzing artifacts. He also has a radio show on KGLT where he plays rock and roll. Adrian Bird Jr., Adrian, give a wave, is also majoring in anthropology at Montana State University and is a recent recipient of MSU's Presidential Emerging Scholars Award, presented to him by President Cruzado a few weeks ago. So congratulations, Adrian. That was a great honor. Adrian is an enrolled member of the Great Crow Nation and is dedicated to learning and teaching the history of the Crow tribe in order to preserve and retain their culture. So thanks so much to all of our presenters this evening, and please join me in welcoming Nancy Mahoney to kick things off.
Good evening, everyone. Tonight, I am going to provide a brief overview surrounding the unauthorized excavations, or the looting, that occurred at the historic site of Fort Ellis in the fall of 2015. However, the emphasis of the presentation is going to be on what we think of as the silver lining, in that we've used this unfortunate event as an opportunity to educate, collaborate, and promote stewardship both at MSU and within the Bozeman community, and we're hoping to wrangle in maybe a few of you who are interested and enjoyed seeing the artifacts outside. We have lots of research needs, and we would love your help. So let's get started. Fort Ellis was established in 1867, ostensibly to protect and support early settlement in the Gallatin Valley, including the Bozeman Trail. The fort became a base of operations and military escorts for early explorations in the Yellowstone region prior to the area's designation as a national park. Fort Ellis also served a major role in the expansion of the Northern Pacific Railroad in the Yellowstone Valley, as well as military operations in the Sioux War of 1876 and 77 and the Nez Perce War of 1877. Eventually, the need for military support declined, and by 1887, Fort Ellis had been decommissioned. 5 years later, in 1892, the 640 acres which comprised Fort Ellis was deeded to the state of Montana, and in 1910, the land was then transferred to Montana State College, which is now MSU Bozeman, for use as an agricultural experiment station. So you can see with the red arrow here is the agricultural experiment station. This is a topo map showing the whole area. Fort Ellis had many, many acres, but the area that we're going to be talking about in terms of excavation and looting is this area up over here. Particularly the laundry quarters is where the artifacts that we showed you and that we're going to be talking about came out of. Since 1910, the site has been subject to regular plowing and grazing, and hunters have been permitted access in season. Perhaps the most significant impact to the site, though, occurred in the early 1960s with the construction of Interstate 90, which you can see running through this photo here. The highway bisected the southern portion of the site. So this is actually north on the slide, and this is south down here. So we're looking at the east side here and west side there, just to get you oriented. So it's in a different orientation than the last one. Where am I? Okay. The highway bisected the southern portion of the site, and several collectors reportedly retrieved hundreds of artifacts that had been exposed during construction. In reports of prior archaeological investigation at Fort Ellis, Ken Karzminski notes that locals have long been familiar with the site of Fort Ellis, and despite several no trespassing signs that have been posted, they have been frequenting the site for decades, and many have regularly come out with metal detectors. Ken Karzminski, spent over a decade investigating Fort Ellis. He conducted field work between 1988 and 1999. And his reports have been invaluable in locating the original structures and have allowed us to determine that the illicit digging occurred within the laundress's quarters, some of them a mere 20 meters from where Karzminski had some of his own test units. So here's some historic maps that we have in the archives in the MSU Special Collections and that Karzminski also went and found in archives in other places. And this is sort of the main barracks area. You can see this isn't to scale, but this would have been where the river, the creek was flowing. The laundress's quarters would have been on this northern end of the site. This is the initial fort as it was initially constructed with a palisade around it. That came down just a couple of years after that, and it became a much more of an open plan, but it expanded well beyond this. And then these are the lists of buildings. The laundress quarters are listed on here. There's a bakery, a hospital, a blacksmith, the officers' quarters, the sutler who sold sort of all sorts of goods at the fort. So there's an amazing array of buildings that were out there, and the area that we're going to be talking about tonight is more up in this portion. There's the laundress quarters. So to start at the beginning, in late October of 2015, a landowner off Kelly Canyon Road reported to Dr. Craig Lee, who I think is here tonight, that he had encountered several individuals who were digging in search of historic artifacts on MSU property at the site of Fort Ellis. Dr. Lee informed the State Historic Preservation Office, as well as members of the Anthropology Department at Montana State University. Reports of the event were disturbing to us because Fort Ellis is located just 3 miles southeast of Bozeman, right in our own backyard. Shortly after hearing about the incident, I decided to go see the damage for myself. This is a photograph that was taken a few months later. When I had initially gone out in November, there was a light covering of snow. I went out with my husband, and we could see a much more massive exposed pit with artifacts than we had expected to see. So despite the light early November blanket of snow, it was clear that the looted area was extensive. The individuals had dug a pit that extended over approximately 35 square meters to an average depth of about 25 square meters. Hundreds of artifacts were plainly visible on the surface, some stacked in piles along the edge of the pit, all exposed to the elements, and winter was coming. Animal bones comprised a significant portion of the visible material, and our immediate concern was that these items were clearly subject to deterioration. I immediately conveyed the extent of the damage to my colleagues at MSU, and we began to consider how best to approach the issue. In the meantime, MSU increased police patrolling of the site and did catch looters at the site and confiscated two beer bottles, which are now curated at the Fort Ellis Collection at Museum of the Rockies. This is one of the only two bottles that the looters said that they had recovered from the site. MSU chose not to press charges, noting that the no trespassing signs were rusted and overgrown with weeds. As reports of the vandalism spread through the archaeological community, several articles began to appear in local newspapers. The Montana Pioneer on January 1st, 2016, an article spearheaded by Dr. Larry Laren. The Billings Gazette on February 8th, 2016. And finally, the Bozeman Chronicle on February 19th of 2016. The article in the Chronicle was prompted by a panel discussion organized by the Gallatin History Museum on February 17th. The museum opened the event to the public, in part, to address local concerns about protecting the site. The panelists included Crystal Alegria, representing the Montana Site Stewardship Program, Bill Jones, the director of the Gallatin History Museum, and MSU representatives Barry Jacobson, associate director of the College of Agriculture, and Tracy Ellig, the executive director of University Communications. Over 80 community members attended the event, and many openly expressed outrage at the scale of the illicit digging that had occurred at Fort Ellis. They raised concerns about how to deal with the vandalized portion of the site and how to protect it from further damage. The momentum generated by that meeting and the follow-up article in the Chronicle led to a collaborative effort among MSU faculty, staff, and administrators to mitigate the site damage and turn the event into an opportunity for undergraduate fieldwork, staff training, and community outreach. We developed a plan to create a silver lining through salvage archaeology, stewardship training, and public engagement. This collaboration continued to grow and now extends far beyond the Bozeman community. We're particularly grateful to assistance from some colleagues in Billings, Dr. Tim Urbaniak and Dr. Tom Rust, both of whom have worked with us on this project. The MSU Anthropology Department faculty and project archaeology developed collaborations with the Agriculture Department, the Gallatin History Museum, and the Museum of the Rockies. And together we applied for a seed grant from MSU's Outreach and Education Department. In May 2016, we received the seed grant as well as matching funds from the Gallatin County Historic Preservation Board. So our next step was to apply for a permit from the State Historic Preservation Office so that we could record the damage, collect the surface artifacts from the vandalized area, and eventually backfill the pit as the best way to protect it. In October of 2016, Dr. Tim Urbaniak came out, and he came complete with his very talented son-in-law who flies a drone and his adorable grandson hiding over there in the orange, and this really cool drone. What they're able to do with this drone is not just photograph the damage from above from an aerial perspective, but also to do 3D imaging and map, so we can actually get an accurate estimate of the extent of the fill that was removed. So when we file our reports for SHPO, we have this data to include now. The following week, so here's what the 3D imaging produces. This is the pit here above the red arrow. And if you look at, this is my sprinter van here. You could park it in this pit. So it's actually a really large hole in the ground. The following week, Dr. Jack Fisher and I laid down a 1x1 meter grid across the surface of the site, mapped the area, and then photographed each unit. Over the next 2 days, we brought 24 MSU undergraduate volunteers to the site to record and collect material from the surface. We limited our collections to animal bones and diagnostic artifacts, those that we could identify that would provide a significant information. So we didn't pick up everything that was even there. We didn't pick up every small piece of glass, small piece of pottery, every metal item. The only thing we completely collected was faunal remains, animal bone. So the artifacts that you're seeing outside are a small portion of what we collected, what we have back in our labs at MSU, and that is a small portion of what was exposed by the looters and left at the site. So we're talking hundreds and hundreds of artifacts. Despite limiting ourselves to diagnostic specimens, we recovered hundreds of items, including metal canteens, buttons, some of the oldest Budweiser bottles ever produced in the nation, fragments of ceramic serving vessels, leather shoes, as well as heaps and heaps of domestic cattle bone. Several students have assisted in the washing and processing of the artifacts, and these three students here in particular are working on independent studies analyzing the animal bone and the bottle glass under the direction of Dr. Fisher and myself. So a couple of the items have already been incredibly interesting, and you'll hear about some of those. This is just another stoneware vessel I found today that by collecting only the pieces that have information and embossing on them, we're able to determine that this was actually produced in the 1850s or 1860s as an inkwell bottle. So you'd use it to refill your smaller ink bottles that you'd dip a pen into. And it was produced in England. That's where they're manufactured. So things were coming from Germany, things were coming from England, things were making their way all the way out to the Montana frontier sometime in the late 1860s, 1870s. So we're starting to get a really interesting picture of what life was like in early Bozeman and at the fort. Some of the other things we have been doing in order to make ourselves familiar with Fort Ellis is to go into the basement here at MSU and look at the previous collections that Kenz Karzminski did in the 1990s when he did some test excavations out at the site. And there's many, many boxes of material back there that's going to also help us. And so some of the analysis that Grace will tell you about with the bottle glass is a comparison from these specimens and the specimens that we recovered in the salvage archaeology. Finally, we also spent some time in the archives in the MSU collections, and there's handwritten letters by people who were stationed at Fort Ellis. There's some diaries of people who were there. There's extensive maps and also Army records about what life was like, sanitary hygiene reports talking about the cleanliness and the state of the buildings and things like that. So it's an amazing amount of fun being able to do archaeology with this wealth of historical data for us to put it into context with. After collecting the artifacts and faunal remains, the Ag Department, and in particular we'd like to thank Bob Brecky, provided sterile soil and the machine power to backfill the pit so that the remaining artifacts and intact deposits are protected for future study. So in addition to all of this, the seed grant that we got has allowed us to enlist Megan Crawford, an undergraduate in the photography department at MSU. She has training in graphic design and is collaborating with us and the Montana Department of Transportation to develop signage at the access point to Fort Ellis and the Ag Station property. The new sign will be posted at the current pullout that right now contains this plaque donated by the Daughters of the Revolutionary War quite a while ago. The new signage will contain more engaging information about the historical and cultural significance of Fort Ellis, as well as notification about the ongoing monitoring and stewardship of the site. Perhaps most importantly, it will invite members of the public, all of you included, to get involved with the analysis of historical documents and artifacts from Fort Ellis. We're hoping that this project grows into a true community collaboration because it is, after all, the community's history. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Grace Dorminen. Thank you.
The Bozeman community has taken an interest in the history of Fort Ellis following looting that took place in 2015. The history that the site holds is rich, and the people who live there can tell us so much about the lives of the people who played such a huge role in making the city of Bozeman what we know it today. The historical information about the people really turns to men and high-ranked officials for insight on what life at the fort was like. Nancy and I's research, however, took a slightly different approach and looks at the taboo notion of women drinking in the laundry. This research began last fall I had just moved out to Bozeman and was enrolled in classes at MSU. In fact, the very first class I had out here was human prehistory taught by Nancy Mahoney. She encouraged my classmates and I to get out in the field, and in less than 2 months of being out in Bozeman, I was helping to unmask important pieces of the Gallatin Valley's history. This image shows the looter's pit at the beginning of my work at this site. The site was prepped by our professors before we arrived and was broken into 1x1 meter squares. Working together, we uncovered countless artifacts, including buttons, shoes, canteens, and animal bones. Some of the most interesting findings, however, were in the form of glass. Several pieces of aqua glass were unmasked from the dirt, reading "Original Budweiser" across the front. In 2015, two complete Budweiser bottles had been turned over by the looters to police. We knew that we had some of the earliest Budweiser bottles ever made, and we began to consider whether the residents of Fort Ellis had a penchant for lager. Nancy and I began to work together on answering this question. In our search for knowledge, we consulted many sources, including Fort Ellis archives at Museum of the Rockies, as well as information on previous fort excavations. We looked at some hand-drawn maps from MSU's special collections in order to get an idea of what part of the fort these artifacts were coming from, and these images confirm that the glass we had found came from an area of the fort occupied by laundresses. From this area, we collected 136 bottle fragments. This was only a fraction of what was at the site. There was so much glass that we had to be a little bit choosy in the fragments we took back to analyze for contents. We looked at specific features of the glass as well as glass coloration to determine what the original contents of the bottles were. So what we found is a lot of alcohol. In fact, over 80% of our total glass assemblage from the site are alcohol bottles, and over half of these are beer bottles. A lot of the bottles that were identified as beer were Budweiser bottles. These bottles contained some of the very first Budweiser beers distributed, dating between 1860 and 1883. These bottles are identified by embossing on their base called a maker's mark. The mark of Carl Conrad and Company, the distributor of Budweiser beers in the late 19th century, is pictured here. This embossing is found on large amounts of the glass findings, which helped us know that we had a lot of beer bottles on our hands. We also found a lot of wine bottles. Wine bottles are made from olive glass, and the most distinguishing feature of these bottles are their bases, which you can see in the picture. On the left, their bases are significantly pushed up, which is something still seen in wine bottles today and is a feature only associated with bottles containing wine, which made up 20% of our collection. We also found liquor bottles. 13% of our glass was from liquor bottles. We again used the maker's mark to identify the contents. The maker's mark shown in these photos is associated with a company that sold specialty beers and whiskey flasks. However, as you can see in the picture, these bottles came in both aqua and amber glass. Our research told us that aqua-colored bottles would have held beer contents, and amber-colored bottles would have contained whiskey or liquor. So we knew which one was which. In summary, we found that at least 83% of the bottle glass we found originally had alcohol in them. That's a huge amount, especially because women on the fort were supposedly not drinking at all. These assumptions did not align with what we were finding, leading us to believe that there was significant information about working class women at Fort Ellis that was left out of historical records. It was at this point we decided we wanted to know more about the daily lives of women, a piece of history too often ignored. And so we asked ourselves, what was it like for single women at this fort? They had left their lives behind to enter into an entirely new world, a world dominated by men. The lack of real insight on females at the fort is likely attributed to their status as a minority, which so often causes groups to be muted from the overall voice. We do know, however, that the women at Fort Ellis were tough, dedicating themselves to grueling amounts of physical labor for a wage they could use to support themselves. To give you an idea of what work these women did, over 400 pounds of water were hauled from the creek to the laundry quarters per woman daily. This water was used to clean the uniforms and bedding for every fort inhabitant. There were 195 listed inhabitants and only 12 listed laundresses. Each laundress then was responsible for the laundry of over 16 people. Imagine collecting, boiling, and hand-washing this much laundry in a time before washers and dryers existed. Furthermore, imagine hauling this water from a distant creek during the whipping winds and snows falls that accompany winters in Montana. These thoughts led Nancy and I to ask ourselves, who are these women? What kind of person would choose the life of an army laundress? And were they, despite strict Victorian-era morals, drinking alcohol on the job? We considered other possibilities. It is likely to assume that men visited women to get some female attention. Several of the women were, after all, wives of the enlisted men. However, records clearly show that the laundress area was for women only, and men, even husbands, had their own quarters. Furthermore, because the laundress quarters housed all the children at the fort, women would have been more likely to go to the barracks of the men for the special visits. Because of this, it is highly suggested that the artifacts we uncovered from this area reflect the consumption of laundresses themselves. We decided to compare these findings to previous excavations done by Ken Karmitsky on the eastern laundress quarters. Karmitsky's assemblage contains far fewer alcohol-related contents and far more medicinal bottles than salvage found in the western portion of the laundry, suggesting a variation in habits among laundresses. This is confirmed in Tom Hurst's book, Lost for Ellis, in which he states that the unrespectable women were not banned from the fort, but rather kept separate from the respectable women, such that they would not influence each other with their habits. A final comparison is made with the glass assemblage obtained from the men's barracks. This excavation yielded 21 complete bottles. All of the bottles recovered contained alcoholic beverages. There were no medicinal or food storage bottles present. Medical records from Fort Ellis show that more men were checked in to the hospital for inebriation than they were for battle wounds during the time that Fort Ellis was in operation. Based on these findings, it seems likely that men were drinking as much as the medical records indicate. So what can we say about these underrepresented working class women at the fort? Are these alcohol bottles indicative of women's daily life at the fort? Without temporal control over the context, it's difficult to determine whether the vast array of alcohol bottles in the West Laundress area were collected during their span at the fort or after. We investigated evidence for alcohol consumption at other 19th century forts in the West to add clarity. In a master's thesis submitted to the Department of Anthropology at the University of Colorado, Gwendolyn Wallensena invested archaeological evidence for alcohol consumption among the laundresses at Fort Garland, a fort that was occupied between 1858 and 1883 in southern Colorado. She found that the laundress quarters, which consisted of four separate buildings, contained ample evidence of alcohol use. A total of 66% of the glass vessel assemblage was unambiguously intended to house alcohol, including ale, beer, whiskey, and champagne. The data from Fort Garland represents a pattern that bears significant similarity to the laundress quarters at Fort Ellis. Our analysis of the salvage assembly from Fort Ellis in conjunction with excavated assemblages reported by both Karmitsky and Wallensena suggests that 19th century working class women as employees of the U.S. Army were indeed drinking in the laundry. No doubt their work was grueling and tedious, and perhaps the Victorian era morals that encouraged abstinence among women were abandoned by the laundresses in frontier forts. The archaeological data suggests that women were likely consuming various types of alcohol on a frequent basis, perhaps as often as enlisted men. We hope that future research on the historical and archaeological record of Fort Ellis will shed additional light on the lives of single women who migrated west in search of ways to build a life for themselves. And now I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Jack Fisher.
Thanks, Grace. I'm going to be talking about research that Danny Krause, who will be talking directly after me, Adrian Bird, who will be talking after Danny separately, and I have been carrying out with the animal bones that we collected from the looting pit at Fort Ellis. When we were collecting those materials, I thought it looked like there were about 30 or 40 bones. You know, when we got it all back to MSU, and Danny and Adrian put in many hours of washing the bones and so forth, and we started cataloging them, it turned out that there were about 250 specimens. And you really are going to be going to be able to learn quite a bit from them. Most of the bones are domestic cattle. I found a few of bones of bird. I think they're chicken. Some, it's probably domestic sheep, possibly pig, and maybe even some elk bones. But by and large, it's domestic cattle. And as we were collecting these bones in the field, I noticed two things that struck me as particularly interesting, given my years of experience analyzing animal bone assemblages, particularly bison bones and pronghorn antelope bones from prehistoric archaeological sites here in Montana. One of them was that a lot of the bones had saw marks on them. They'd been sawed and chopped with metal saws, chopped with metal axes and hatchets and so forth. And a few of them had cut marks from knives. And I thought we could learn a great deal about how the carcasses were butchered and so forth and used by the folks at Fort Ellis. And that's what Danny's going to talk about, the saw marks and chop marks when I'm finished. And the second thing that I noticed was that based on my experience of analyzing lots of animal bone assemblages from ancient prehistoric Native American sites, that the bones, the parts of the skeleton of the cattle that were most common, that we were finding most frequently at the bone assemblage, are bones that were sort of very different from the patterns that I saw in my analysis of bones from prehistoric archaeological sites. So that's what I'm going to focus on, because it turns out that in archaeological analyses of animal bone assemblages like this, one can learn a great deal by counting up which parts of the skeleton are most common, which parts of the skeleton are most rare, and we can learn a lot about how the people were butchering and using these carcasses. And the bones that you see in black there, or the parts of the bones, are the parts of the skeleton of the cows that were most common in what we brought back, those 250 or so bones that we brought back from Fort Ellis. And that pattern is sort of the exact opposite of what I typically find when I've been analyzing prehistoric archaeological sites. And I want to just tell you a little bit about what this sort of thing might mean or might not mean. One of the interesting aspects of analyzing the frequencies of bones is that animal bones possess a lot of grease. And people's ancient hunter-gatherers, whether it's here in Montana in the Great Plains or up in the Arctic or in Europe during the Paleolithic period, in temperate environments, bone grease, the grease you could extract from bones, was an important nutrient. And we get too much fat in our diets these days, but ancient hunter-gatherers didn't. And so the grease in bones could be a very important source of nutrients for them. And in a leg bone, typical leg bone, most of the grease is located in the ends, like in this modern deer that has been cross-sectioned. You can see that honeycomb bone at each end. That's where most of the bone grease is. And some bones have a lot of grease at both ends. This is a femur, the thigh bone, and the top of the bone is to the left. That's called the proximal end. But other bones, leg bones, have very little grease. And this is interesting and important in our analysis, because we would expect, other things being equal, that in an assemblage of bones, say a prehistoric bison kill site, where people have been processing bones intensively to get grease, that the bones that that have the most grease would be the bones that are processed most intensively. And an archaeologist in Alberta, Canada, who's done a lot of work at the Bison Kill Sites, he did a lot of research on measuring how much grease is present in the different parts of the limb bones, and this is his ranking from the at the very top of the list. So those ones in highlighted in black are the parts of the bones that have the most amount of grease in them. The humerus is the forelimb bone. The proximal simply means the upper end of the bone. Distal means the lower end of the bone. And getting back to that illustration, that's those parts of the bone in black are the bones that parts of the bones that have the highest amount of grease in a bison skeleton, which I think is analogous to what we'd expect in cattle. And the way, and this is one of the cow humeri, the proximal end of the humerus, from Fort Ellis, the both sides of the bone, and you can see all of that trabecular honeycomb bone on the image on the right, just loaded with grease. And the way that one extracted that grease in ancient times was to smash the bone up into little pieces, boil it in water, and the grease would float to the top, and then you skim it off. So you think of this as sort of a before and after photograph. This is what the proximal end of humerus would look like before it's been processed for grease. In that photograph on the left, all those little tiny fragments is what it would look like after it's been processed for grease. And that bigger piece of bone in on that photograph on the left is just the shaft part of the bone. It doesn't have much grease, and those would not have been broken up. And this is from an archaeological site here in Montana that I analyzed the bones from. It's about 1,000 years old. There were over 80 pronghorn antelope killed, and they were butchered. The bones were processed very thoroughly for grease, and we just have sacks and sacks of that little tiny fragments of bone. So our prediction, our expectation is that, other things being equal, if a bone assemblage, if folks killed a bunch of bison or pronghorn or whatever, or domestic cattle, and if they processed them heavily for grease, the bones or parts of bones that we would expect to be least common in what we find in our excavations are those parts of the bone that have the most grease in them, because those are the ones that will be smashed up to boil and they will no longer be identifiable. And indeed, at the Lost Terra site, that's exactly what happens. Whoops, wrong button. This down on this thing, this is Jack Brink's grease value, so the bones that have the most grease, this is grease by weight, 350 grams, zero, and this is the count of bones, the number of bones in the Lost Terrace pronghorn antelope assemblage, so very few bones, very high frequencies. And the bones that have the lowest frequency, the lowest counts of bones in Lost Terrace are precisely those that have the most amount of grease in them, just what we would expect if they'd been heavily processed and smashed up. And what we, this is from Fort Ellis. This is a humerus, the forelimb bone, and that one in the middle is a modern cow from my comparative collection, just to show you what a complete humerus looks like. This has been sawed. These have both been sawed. And the bones, the single most numerous bone in Fort Ellis in the collection of ours is the proximal end of the humerus, the bone that has the greatest amount of grease. So if we plot the Fort Ellis, it's the mirror image, it's the exact opposite of that Lost Terrace thing. The bones that are most frequent at Fort Ellis are the ones that have the most grease in them. So whatever they were doing when they were butchering the cattle and using them, they were not processing those bones for grease, like ancient hunter-gatherers did in temperate environments in the Great Plains, in the Arctic, in Northern Europe, and so forth. So that's kind of interesting. I find that an interesting insight. We may think, well, that seems pretty self-evident. They had could probably buy grease and so forth in stores, but nonetheless, it's important and valuable to document this, and we can compare this pattern to other historic sites. So if they were not rendering bones for grease, what were they doing with the cattle? And fortunately for me, I'm a novice in historical archaeology, other archaeologists, including specialists in analyzing animal bones, have done a lot of work with analyzing animal bones from historic sites. And one way of looking at this is the different cuts of beef, because that's how probably the cattle were being butchered at Fort Ellis. And one thing we might look at is which parts of the carcass is the ratio of meat to bone highest with respect to meat. And we might expect that maybe the quartermaster or the cooks, whoever, if they were buying parts of carcasses, they would buy those parts of the carcass that had the most meat and the least amount of bone. So that's something we can test in the future. We haven't done these sorts of analyses yet. And another alternative is using historical data. Some archaeologists have ranked the different cuts of beef by their value. So when we could look at the Fort Ellis assemblage and say, well, you know, were they eating the most expensive cuts, the least expensive cuts, or whatever? Haven't done that analysis yet, but we will. Or, as we could follow the lead of some archaeologists, and we could combine those two measures, you know, get the most bang for your buck if you're the quartermaster or the cook by buying those parts of the carcass, the cuts that have the most amount of meat and the least amount of bone, and also the least, you know, sort of medium, moderate cost. So, in fact, the round and the chuck are ones that were fairly moderately priced, you know, and have lots of meat on them. So these are some directions that we think we can go in the future. I'm kind of interested to know where the officers had better food than the enlisted men did. We can't really test that because we don't know whether these bones were from what officers ate or enlisted men or all thrown together. But these are some of the interesting questions that we can look at in the future. So I'm going to turn it now over to Danny, and Danny will tell us about cut marks and chop marks on these bones.
Thank you, Professor Fisher. So my job upon being becoming a part of this Fort Ellis project was to analyze the bone faunal elements that had come in from Fort Ellis itself and kind of analyze the cut marks, chop marks that we saw and determine if there's a pattern or anything like that with the butchery. This is a highlight of some of the bones that I was... And remember, these samples here are just a highlight of the 250 samples we got here. There was a lot. Couldn't really put everything on there. These are just a sample of the bones we took, the scapulas we were talking about with the chuck, a few pieces around the pelvic, a couple tibias and radii and ulna. A lot of patterning there as far as disarticulation during the butchery. And each of the images that we'll be following are also accompanied by an osteology book that I scanned in, or with the help of Dr. Fisher, and edited to kind of represent the bone. And we also have photos of the actual samples themselves. First one here is just your typical radius. This was one of the most popular bones that we found here at Fort Ellis, containing a really common feature at the distal end. It was just a complete clean saw mark on it, just cut off and missing. And that actually plays into a theory we'll talk in a little bit later about how we think the butchery may or may not have happened. Another one, this one was actually two samples on the table outside. It was an articulated radius and ulna, again cut with the same saw at the angle, really down there at the distal end. And just one of those things that we saw all too often when looking at these bones. This is the actual sample out there. This is the two pieces that are articulated together, with the ulna being broken from whether just gone through the saw and oh, it broke, or damage from looters maybe. Here's the actual cut mark that we see. If you look kind of closely on the outer rim here, it's what's called the kerf wall. We'll have better images of other ones later. There's little striations there that show that this was cut with a saw. Couldn't really tell you exactly how many teeth or how thick they were, but it definitely was a ridge saw. Your typical, if you think of a saw, that's what it is. This was another radius that we had found. Again, same patterning, a little bit of excess damage and some discoloration, nothing too out of the ordinary. Maybe possible predatory tooth marks, canid. We're not considering that for sure. Here's the actual sample itself. Marks up there, cut right at the same end right there as usual, and just the scarring left from the ulna. Next one is the tibia, which we didn't have too many solidly complete tibias So finding this one was actually really, really cool, especially because it actually had a few false starts or continuations with the saw marks itself. That V right there that you see, we'll get into a little bit more, actually has a little bit of a false mark. This is the actual bone itself, so we're looking at the anterior side right here, getting on into the V. You can see the carafoil is rather rigid and coarse, which means there's fewer teeth on the saw than what we typically see, like if you're using a really fine wood saw cutting into there. Down here at the distal end where it was separated, you can still see the carafoil is rather coarse. But what's interesting to note about this one is it wasn't completely sawed all the way through, and it had actually been broken off, so they could have busted over their knee or just gone through it and cracked it off and discarded it with the rest of the what we would call wrist and ankle bones of the cow, which is why we think the cattle were actually processed off-site, or at least not directly at Fort Ellis where we were finding these bones. Next one is kind of involving the chuck meat, the scapula. We got a couple scapulas. This one actually was cut rather interesting, particularly because that angle of that saw cut, that cuts. So if you look at the scapula and you hold it here by the part that would connect to the shoulder bone, essentially it was cut to where the, we're just going to call it a handle of the fan for the sake of the argument here, is just missing, gone. Little damage from weathering and stuff as well, a few little cut marks. But this is the one that was really interesting because it was cut off at the vertical angle, completely different angle from the other one, and not only presented saw evidence, but our best evidence for chop marks, or a hand axe mark. Right here, you can actually see the mark here, the obtuse angle going in right there. For anybody who's ever cut wood, if you cut down into the wood, you're going to see like a little weird angle. That's what we're looking for, is that angle right there. And as you look to the keep going to the left on the sample here, you can actually see there's multiple strike marks on this scapula here, which means it was definitely sawed off, but they definitely were chopping on it as well, which is rather interesting to see two different methods for butchery and disarticulation. We also have some pelvic bones that were involved getting that round meat as well up there. All of them were rather similar cut to the one that was represented right here. But what's interesting to note about this one is there's actually two distinct carafoils on here, which means one of two things. One thing for sure, the two saws were used on this butchering of this animal. But does that mean that two people were working on it, or they just decided to use a different saw? The one on the left over here is rather fine and a little bit hard to see, but you can make it out there. While the one on the right here is rather coarse and rigid, meaning the one on the left had a lot more teeth, so it was just getting in there, getting it all done, while the one on the right had fewer teeth. And that's just kind of a sample of what we have from Fort Ellis and what this can impose, and this whole thing can impose, as far as potential research is. Well, for us as undergrads, we've gotten an excellent experience not only at the field, but at what happens at an archaeological site when it's looted. And frankly, that happens a little too much for all of our liking, but it's important. I think this could be used as a potential learning project for other places around the country who are suffering similar fates like that. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Adrian Bird.
Good evening. With my role, with all the bone collecting, I got to wash all the bones. So you were able to see this, so Danny and Jack could see the scarrings on the bones. But after the fifth bone, looking at it, I sat back and looked at the rest of the bags, the bones, all the mud on them. I thought to myself, archaeology field, my career has just started. So we're gonna take a turn here on learning about Fort Ellis. I'll be doing talking to you about the ties that they had with Fort Parker, 35 miles down the road, just on the other side of Livingston, the First Crow Agency. This presentation is about the role of the military at Fort Ellis in the development and maintenance of civilian society in the region and the relationship shared with the Upsaliga, the Crow. The 16,000-acre military reserve at Fort Ellis was found to provide a strategic military presence near the divide separating the Gallatin Valley and the Yellowstone River. The aim was to provide protection from the Blackfeet Indians in the Missouri headwaters region and to defend the Yellowstone country against the Sioux raids. Fort Ellis troops helped support the First Crow Reservation, whose headquarters were located at Fort Parker near the confluence of Mission Creek and the Yellowstone River. The history of the Upsaliga people with Fort Parker and Fort Ellis, 1869 through 1875. Left to right, Poor Elk, Blackfoot, better known as Sits in the Middle of the Land. In my language, Awakwinawajish. Long Ears, Shows His Face, Old Onion. I wanted to throw this picture in there. This picture was taken in Arlington National Cemetery in 1921. Chief Plinicoop was selected as the sole representative of Native American for the dedication of the tomb of an unknown soldier, and gave a short speech in his native language. In honor of the soldier and the occasion, he placed his war bonnet and coop stick upon the tomb. This is the relationship that my tribe, the Upsaliga, had with the U.S. military. I want to share a vision of how this all began. And it was Chief Plinicoop's vision as a young boy, starting from the age of 9 when he was his first going out on by himself up to the high peaks, high plains, four nights. The last chief of the Crow, Plinicoop, spearheaded the Crow's strategy to cooperate with the U.S. Army during the Plains War of the 1870s. Plinicoop went on a fast, as he did on several occasions throughout his life, in hopes of receiving a vision which would give him power and direction. In his greatest vision, he saw the buffalo disappear and spotted buffalo or cattle appear in their place. A forest was destroyed by a storm, except a single tree. This tree held the lodge of the Chickadee, who survived the storm because he was a sharp listener who learned from the others and knew where to pitch his lodge. The dream was interpreted to mean that the cattle which replaced the buffalo represented the whites taking over the Crow country. The tree which survived was the Crows, who would survive the coming of the white man, because like the Chickadee, they listened and learned from the experiences of other tribes and pitched their lodges in the right place. The powerful vision guided Plinicoop through his life. It told him to adapt to and cooperate with the whites so the Crows would survive and prosper. It guided him as leader of the tribe through the difficult times ahead. Chief Plinicoop and 135 warriors volunteered to become scouts for General George Cook in the 1876 campaign against the Cheyenne and the Sioux. Crow scouts were also with General Custer at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. After the battle, Crow warriors under Plinicoop's continued to support the U.S. Army as it pursued the Sioux and the Cheyenne. In conclusion, The relationship between the U.S. military at Fort Ellis and the Apsaloga was beneficial for the U.S. government, but in the end, it was not beneficial for the Apsaloga. The relationship, though relationship, became more complex as time went on and is still complex, but the transitional period holds a great deal of importance of the Apsaloga. The people of Montana and every U.S. citizen who now benefit from this rich history. Thank you.
This is where Fort Ellis is, and Fort Parker. They're exactly 35 miles apart.
So I want to thank Adrian and Danny and Jack and Grace for their presentations. And I think one of the reasons we wanted to end with Adrian's part in this project is we never want to forget that this is about, I mean, it started with a situation about looting, but this is really all about a story about people and voices that have been lost to us in the past and the incredible impact that this fort, which supported the town of Bozeman, was an economic engine. The impact that it had on the entire ecology of this valley and the surrounding area and the ecosystem, and most importantly, the lives of all the people who were living here and making a living here before you had all of these immigrants coming in who settled in the valley. So it's a fascinating story that we have so much historical information and a lot more archaeological work to do. So we're excited to have anybody in the community who's interested contact us and get involved. And one of the other ways we're hoping people might participate is to engage in stewardship of archaeological sites, historical sites in the area, to help keep them protected. So we have some training for the Montana Site Stewardship Program that's coming up in June. Is that right, Crystal? Okay. June, she says yes. I think it's on there. And this one's going to be right here in Bozeman. And the idea is that sites that we value, that are important to the community, they're important to all of our histories, you would go and visit them once every couple months or on a more regular basis if you can, just to make sure that either impacts, erosion, environment, or impacts, human impacts, aren't really creating the disappearance of a site that's important to us.